put down his lawyership. He managed to write a really, really interesting book. I hope you all take a look at it. It's fascinating, it's well written, and it's right on point. Stuart?
This one. It really is a pleasure to be here, and I thank Spike for all the things he didn't say. We go back a long way. The one thing he didn't say that he probably should have that might be most relevant to the folks in this room is that I went to college with John Rizzo, whom many of you probably can thank for being here and not incarcerated. John and I were in college together, which means that I have plenty of Rizzo stories, but since he's got plenty of Baker stories, we won't be telling any of those here. I did persuade him just recently, since he left the agency, to join Steptoe and practice a little law with us. So I'll be spending time with him now at the tail end of the career that he had at CIA, as well as the beginning of it. What I'm going to talk about today is the fruits of the work I did at DHS. You know, many people in the 9/11 Commission said that what failed in 9/11 was our imagination, that we had not thought hard enough about the kinds of risks we faced. And one of the things that I tried to do at DHS was think a little bit about what the risks are that we aren't spending enough time on that are inevitably arising here. And that's what I'm going to be talking about. Three places where changes in technology have made potentially dramatic changes in our risks and vulnerabilities. And so I thought I'd talk about them. And I'm going to begin by talking about the bicycle and exponential change, a theory I have about that, and then about what jet travel, the original technology that seized the imagination of an entire generation, what it did to our border security, and then to Moore's Law and how it is changing our lives today in exponential ways, and then what we can expect from biotechnology, the newest exponential technology that's going to transform our lives in good ways and potentially in bad. But first, I want to offer a thought, which is this really where we went wrong? That moment when we were teaching, when we were being taught by our dads to ride a bike, and just as he's running alongside us, and he lets go, and about 30 seconds later, we realized, gee, he's not holding on. And that kind of moment of elation and betrayal that you feel. The reason I think that's a potentially important psychological moment is that it's then that we learned, you know, that after all, we felt like we were being held up. There was something giving us stability as we went, and we thought, well, it must be Dad's hand. But in fact, it was the natural inertial stability that arises from a bicycle in motion. And that understanding that something could become more stable as it begins to move, as it accelerates, is, I think, a psychological discovery that has affected our approach to a bunch of other technologies, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. First, let me start with the invention of the bicycle. Now, it is possible, let me see if I can... It's been possible to actually create a bicycle since the 6th century B.C. You've got an axle, you've got wheels, you've got an ability to link them. All you had to do with this chariot is move the wheels around, and you would have had the bicycle that was ultimately invented in 1817 with a wooden body, wheels, and an axle. Now, the question that I have asked is, why did it take from the 6th century BC until 1817 for somebody to invent the bicycle. And it turns out that it took two things to create a bicycle, two very remarkable developments. First, the greatest military genius of the modern era, Napoleon, who twice looked as though he was going to conquer Europe, was finally defeated. We know it was finally. They didn't. In 1815, after having escaped from exile, raised an army and almost beaten the assembled armies of Europe, they exiled him again. They didn't dare execute him. And so one of the things that if you were a military planner in 1815 you began to worry about was, what's going to happen if he escapes from exile again? How are we going to deal with the need to fight a war in 1816? In addition, what happened in 1816 was that Mount Tambora blew. It blew the entire volcano apart, the biggest volcanic eruption in the modern era, and it sent so much ash into the air that there was no summer that year in the Northern Hemisphere. Simply none. All of the forage crops failed. That meant that the pack animals who depended on forage also died. And by the end of what was supposed to be summer 1816, those military planners who were asking themselves what to do if Napoleon escaped from exile had to ask, and how are we going to fight him without any pack animals? And that is what led Carl von Drais, who was a petty official in a German principality, to say, I got it. We'll turn our infantrymen into pack animals by putting them on this thing I have invented. What was crucial about that, and from that very quickly people started using it. They discovered that, in fact, it was more stable in motion than it was when it was at rest. And very quickly they put pedals on it, and within 15, 20 years we had the modern bicycle that ended up transforming transportation systems, making possible the invention and use of the automobile. But the critical moment, in my view, was not just that those two things had to come together, but people had to get on that bicycle and discover that they were safer moving than when they sat on it without being in motion. And that discovery that acceleration can produce stability is also the discovery we all made when Dad let go of the back of the seat, that you can have a status quo that involves acceleration, and it's actually better than trying to stand still. That has shaped our view of technology and the future, and it's part of the American optimism about where technology is taking us. It works until it doesn't. And at some point, we all discover that you can't just keep accelerating and getting more and more stable. Sooner or later, something else happens in the course of that acceleration, a secondary, tertiary, quaternary effect. Suddenly, what had been very stable is completely unstable. And the consequences of falling off are a lot more than just skinning your knee because you were standing up and fell over. You're now going 40 miles an hour and you're landing on your face. And so that's what this talk is about. It's where is this technology and our optimism about the technology taking as it accelerates, as we settle in for this great, stable, accelerating ride? At what point do we lose control and end up on our face, and what can we do about it? So that's what the book is more or less about. As I said, I'm going to cover three technologies: jet travel, which people were in love with for, an entire generation was in love with that in a way that some parts of our generation have been in love with computers, and the way in which they caused international jet travel to double really every 5 years for probably 50 years, and what that did to our border defenses. And then the downside of Moore's Law and the downside of biotech, which is following Moore's Law pretty swiftly. Jet travel. Until 1950 or so, every passenger who got off the boat, which is the way you got here internationally, got questioned, got their effects gone through. They had to have gotten a gone through a screening process in their home country to get a visa. All of those measures were in effect, and we could afford to spend time with every single traveler who arrived when they got off the ship. And those measures worked into the 1970s, but as travel doubled and doubled and doubled and doubled, pretty soon we got down to the point where we couldn't spend more than 30 seconds with any traveler. And we got rid of the visa program because there were too many people who wanted to travel, and we couldn't have them standing in line out in the rain in Paris and London to get a visa. We wanted them here so that they could buy tickets to Disneyland. And so we got rid of visas. We said, well, what's the worst that can happen? These are not people who want are likely to steal dishwashing jobs in New York City from Americans. They're at a relatively sophisticated level of economic development. We don't have to worry that they're going to engage in illegal immigration. And what else is there to worry about? So in the 1980s, we pretty much dismantled all of our border security measures for large parts of the population of the world. And we're under pressure to continue to do that as the international travel continued to double. And it did that right up through 2001 until we recognized that there might be something worse that they could do in New York City than get an illegal dishwashing job. And that led to, and this is mostly what I talk about in the book, an effort to rethink border security. And to rethink it, and I did come from an NSA background and a WMD commission background to understand what intelligence could do. So I played a part in this transformation, which was to say, wait a minute, we don't have to stop everybody and go through everybody's luggage. Why don't we figure out who's coming in advance? Why don't we compare that to the list of all the people in the world that we're worried about, and then make sure they can't change their identity by getting a new passport, and then we'll focus on those people, and we'll just select one out of every couple hundred, and they'll get the 1950 treatment, and everybody else will get a stamp in their passport, welcome to America, and waved on through. And that's basically the mechanism that we came up with to say we can get some security, and we can continue to accommodate lots of travel if we use intelligence and information about travelers in an effective way. And that is indeed the mechanism that we apply today, and it's one I'm pleased to say that it's one area where the Obama administration, if anything, has been more enthusiastic and more aggressive about using travel data and focusing on the integration of intelligence and travel data in order to prevent people from coming to the United States that mean us harm. So that it's, I think, you know, if no policy is really permanent until two different administrations from different parties have endorsed it, I think we can say this is now a permanent part of the landscape. Now, one last thing, and I spent a lot of time on this. I won't spend so much time in the talk, but you would have thought this would be easy, that improving border security would be one of what my daughter calls a no-duh moment. That, of course, you've got to do that after, you know, after you've lost 3,000 people. Something went wrong. We did keep one of the 20 planned hijackers out of the country, but it took substantial amounts of bureaucratic courage. I actually did some reporting on this. I talked to the guy who kept Catani out, who probably saved the Capitol by doing that, because he would have probably been the fifth hijacker on Flight 93 in a position to exercise more control over the passengers than the four hijackers were able to do, and they might well have completed their mission. It didn't come easy, because as many of you who've worked in government know, keeping well-to-do Saudi tourists out of Orlando would not ordinarily be good for your career. And that's what he decided to do. And he had to find a reason. He said, I knew this guy. I thought he was a hired killer, but I didn't know what he was up to. But I knew he was here to do something wrong, and I didn't want to let him in. But I couldn't find a good reason. He had a visa. He had all of his paperwork in order. There was nothing except my gut that said he shouldn't be here. And my gut wasn't going to be good enough for the U.S. ambassador to Saudi when we got a complaint. And so they actually had to go through this process in which having worn the guy out, asking him obnoxious questions about what he was doing and why he was here and what his future plans were and how long he was staying and how much money he had with him, all the questions you asked, the guy was getting more and more taciturn, more and more uncooperative. They went back and put him under oath and asked him, started asking him the questions again. He said, screw you, I don't have to answer these questions. I've already answered this stuff. And it happens that there's a statutory provision that says if you refuse to answer questions under oath, you can be excluded from the United States. And having basically tricked him into not answering the questions under oath, they had an airtight justification for kicking his butt out of the United States, and they did. A very near thing, and something that I think we're all aware is, you know, this is somebody who knew how to work the system and worked it right. I talk a little bit about why the system failed after in the run-up to 9/11. A lot of you were probably around for that. I think you'll find some things you never knew about how the wall was jammed into not just the interstices between the intelligence community and law enforcement, but right down the middle of the FBI in a way that in the end, the FBI guys who had the resources had a team already set up to investigate the coal bombing. They knew that they were told, they shouldn't have been told because of the wall, but they had been told that there were these two bad guys from Al-Qaeda here. We already knew they had come into the United States. We could have found them. We just had to go to the airline reservation system to find them. And the wall that had been jammed between the intelligence side of the FBI and the law enforcement side of the FBI was being enforced in a fashion that was basically making it clear that the FISA court would have your career if you did not adhere to that wall in the strictest possible fashion. And so when the coal bombing team said, we just found out about these guys, we can find them, just let us at them. This was August, late August of 2001. Just let us go, please. The lawyers and everybody who understood what the FISA court was up to said, no, you're on the wrong side of the wall, buddy. Sit down, shut up, leave it to the undermanned intelligence side of the FBI to find them. And, of course, we all know they didn't. So there are real consequences to the bureaucratic policies that we follow, and you can't always expect the kind of envelope-pushing bureaucratic behavior that we saw that kept out Catani. It's much more likely that the more aggressively you pursue civil liberties and privacy, the less security you're going to get. And that's part of a theme of the book. But I spend a lot of time talking about the resistance we got even after that failure demonstrated that point. We had civil liberties groups fighting our efforts to get information about travelers. Really, within a year and a half of 9/11, there was a major counterattack on our security measures. The European Union joined forces with the civil liberties groups to try to say that we could not have access to information about Europeans unless we put the wall back in place. Kind of a breathtaking assertion on the part of the European Union, and one that they actually made stick briefly because they caught DHS when it was just organizing. And I talk a little bit about the story of how in an effort to improve their hand, they went to the European Court of Justice and said, we'd like to reopen that deal Can you strike this agreement down so we can get a better deal? By then, the policy office was in place, and we had Secretary Chertoff, who understood the wall as secretary. And we couldn't have been more delighted. They reopened the negotiations, and they have been retreating ever since. They've been losing things that they got in that first agreement with every effort to renegotiate. And I'm hoping they've tried to the reopening for the third time in this administration. I'm hoping they may lose the whole agreement. That was the story of the resistance, and I try to draw from that some lessons about what we're going to be able to do in the future, because having identified this one loss of arising from exponential technology, I asked, as we started this discussion with, using our imagination, and not much imagination, what disasters can we see coming as technologies, other technologies, follow the same exponential growth that international travel did? And the answer is, we looked at two technologies. One, we're right in the middle of living the consequences for, and that's cyber. I mean, we all love what technology has done, what Moore's Law has done for us. It's brought that, and the Internet has brought us to the doorstep of every single library, every expert in the world. And we can bring those resources into our living rooms, and it has transformed the way we research, the way we think, the way we shop, the way we work. Unfortunately, you know, a few years down the road, it also brought the world's thieves and the world's scam artists and the world's spies and the world's soldiers into our living rooms, and that's the consequence that we are living with now. The insecurity industry, as I call it here, has gone from counting coup, just showing off, saying, ha-ha, look at me, I can break into the Air Force's computer system just for the sake of the bragging rights, to discovering that they can make money doing this. And now hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, and not just the phony losses that the recording industry talks about, but real money is being stolen from real citizens and small businesses in the United States as a result of being able to break into people's computers. One of the problems that we had for years, though I'm sure there are people here who felt that they were preaching about the risks 10, 15 years ago, and for sure they were, is that we did it in a classified context, and the antibodies against doing anything were such that people dismissed any classified report of cyber insecurity as self-interest on the part of authoritarians in government who just wanted to run the Internet and screw it up. And so business and privacy groups campaigned ferociously. Actually, they didn't have to campaign ferociously. They lifted their finger and swatted us aside when we complained about this, because we were not able to explain to ordinary Americans why they would care about this. One of the nicest things that has happened in this area since we began fighting over this 10 years ago is that there's been a completely unclassified examination of some of the tactics that are used by intelligence services around the world. And the best of them was a study of the Dalai Lama's computer system and the compromise of the Dalai Lama's computer system by a set of attackers who some of the investigators identified as working for Chinese intelligence, and others left it up to you to make that conclusion. But for a bunch of reasons, that would seem to be the most obvious conclusion. But because this was the Dalai Lama's network, and because the researchers who found the attack were part of a Canadian nonprofit, their report's completely unclassified, and it shows just how sophisticated these attacks can be. In this case, a member of the Dalai Lama's staff participated in a variety of electronic fora. He met a few people, exchanged a lot of information with them. One of them said, "Oh, and you'll want to take a look at this document. I'll send it to you." He then emailed it to him. The guy was expecting the document. It was from somebody he thought he knew. It was indeed a document he wanted to read. It was a Word document. When he opened it and read it, it sent out no signals that would suggest that there was a problem. In fact, it was malware infected with malware that was designed to escape most of the existing commercial antivirus systems then in place. And it immediately infected his system and then gradually the rest of the Dalai Lama's network. And when they were done doing that with techniques that most of us would fall victim to as well, they had effective control, and they had done this so often that they'd actually developed a graphic user interface for the kiddie spies who were trying to keep track of the Dalai Lama's activities. And so what you see here is a drop-down menu for the spies. It says, "Do you want to log all the keystrokes that this person is putting into his computer? Here, just check this little box. Would you like to turn on his camera and watch him sitting at his desk? Well, just click this box. And if you want to turn on his mic and listen to him talk, you can click this box." So there in a drop-down menu, Windows-friendly, is the full 1984 package, with one difference. At least in 1984, you got the impression that the state had paid for all the equipment. In this case, it was the Dalai Lama who had paid for the equipment. These guys were curious about this. They said, you know, if you're a spy, a cyber spy, and you need a graphic user interface, how good can you be, really? And again, in something that luckily they didn't ask me whether it was legal, they found their way to the server to which all of this stuff was being sent in encrypted form. And they said, you know, I wonder if these guys are as bad at securing their server as they are at conducting espionage. And sure enough, they had bad security on the server that was collecting all this data, and it was easy enough to log on and to see what was happening on the server. And there, sure enough, were all the Dalai Lama's stuff, all his negotiating positions, all of his emails being exfiltrated and downloaded to the server and then, you know, passed on to another location. And they said, well, that's real interesting. What's interesting is that this is just one of several hundred compromised systems from different IP addresses that are sending back whatever is of interest to those script kiddie spies that were using the keyloggers and otherwise compromising the network. So the entire telephone network of Venezuela going back there, Deloitte and Touche in New York, it was being sent back. Associated Press was being sent back there. Practically every Indian embassy anywhere in the world was being sent back there, and a number of embassies from a number of other countries. I think the Vietnam Petroleum Corporation was also dutifully reporting back all its secrets. This is just one not especially sophisticated activity that was happening in cyberspace that could happen to any of us. And indeed, it is now being used by criminals to steal electronic funds transfer credentials from businesses around the world, including yours if you're not careful, because while most of us are protected as individual bank account customers from loss, and the banks will make good our losses, if you're a small business and you're using electronic funds transfer, you sign a little document that says the bank will never be liable, basically. It doesn't have to do anything. It's your problem if you lose money as a result of compromise of your network. And so most banks don't even send people key fob tokens or anything else that would give them security. It's all entirely a question of how much information they, the password, the PIN, maybe some challenge questions for security, all things that can be learned just by sitting on the guy's system for a month or two, at which point you can log on from wherever you are and answer all the challenge questions and order transfers of funds to wherever you like. And that's happening to the tune of some hundreds of millions of dollars as we speak. So that's the risk I see here. I talk a little bit about what we did to try to head it off and how much luck we had, and the answer is not much. It is still the case that the privacy industry, the privacy lobby, has been able, with some help from the industries that depend on Moore's Law constantly accelerating the power and scope and reach of IT, to flick away the efforts that the government has made to try to bring security to the Internet. I think that's beginning to change, but it's only beginning to change, and it won't change really until we have a disaster, maybe a financial disaster, that is equivalent in scope to what happened on September 11. The good news, I guess, is that we're getting there. Last, biotechnology. Biotech is quite self-consciously following the model that was set by the computer industry, that if we democratize this, if we can lower the cost of building new organisms, of creating new life, at a rate of, cutting in half the cost every 18 months, every year or so, sooner, and make that ability something that everybody can access, then it will unleash a wave of creativity enthusiasm that will lead to totally unexpected and remarkable new technologies. And curing cancer, curing disease is something that people think, yeah, maybe at last it's within our grasp. But that's the good news. But I put down the arc of insecurity in the computer industry, where we began in 1972 with Captain Crunch getting a whistle out of the cereal box and discovering that he could blow a tune that would fool the AT&T dial tone system into believing that he was an authorized user who could get free long-distance phone calls, to people beginning to make mistakes. The first worm was an error that wasted every machine in a particular company in 1979. And then in 1988, Robert Morris released, probably intentionally, a worm that brought down the Internet briefly. By 2003 or so, people had begun to figure out they could make money at this, and we were off to the races. Insecurity was ramping up at an exponential rate until today, and if you only have to read the headlines about the Stuxnet virus, clearly a weapon of war designed to achieve bombs could not achieve, the destruction of a particular industrial facility in a particular place. So over more or less 30 years, we saw that arc of insecurity. And what has happened is that biotech has gone through almost exactly that process, from cuteness, glow-in-the-dark tobacco leaves, to mistakes in which people have suddenly discovered that they were making changes in mouse pox that made mouse pox extraordinarily fatal and infectious. Gradual intentional creation of new dangerous viruses, polio, cold and flu viruses, and we are now at a point where it is not hard for probably 10, 15, 20 labs around the world today to reconstruct smallpox. It's just a question of will. We have gone past the point in sophistication where smallpox can be found, and people don't consider smallpox a technical challenge anymore. But as the cost of building viruses go down, the number of people who will be able to build the virus of a particular complexity continues to grow. And so, you know, if we have a generation of exponential reductions in cost, we're going to have an enormous number of people who are capable of constructing fatal viruses, including smallpox, and releasing them on the world. This, too, is an exponential technology that we must learn to control and which we have no idea how to control today. So I talk a little bit about some of the things that we have tried to do, the uses of intelligence that will allow us to identify in advance people who are engaged in research activities that we think will lead on to misuse of biotech. But I have to say, of all the technologies that I talk about, this is the one which I most fear will be misused in ways that are truly society-shaking in their consequences. So I often end this sort of discussion by saying, you know, do you ever get a tune in your head that just goes over and over and over again, repeats and repeats until you can give it to somebody else? So I feel that way with my nightmares, that, you know, I'll sleep better tonight, and I want to thank you for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Stu. As our custom is that we usually have a gift for our speakers. The Smith & Wesson was stopped at the border. It is being mailed, and it will be mailed to you, Stu. Thank you.
You going to have Q&A?
Yeah, sure.
Good.
Okay, no, I'm glad to take questions. Yes?
My question is related to border security. There were reports even during the Clinton administration that were compiled by a local law enforcement agency that many thousands other than Mexicans of people of Middle Eastern origin have been crossing over the U.S.-Mexican border. Why is that so difficult to
So the question is, you talked a lot about border security, and it was almost all in the context of actual ports of entry where actually people landed and we had an opportunity to inspect them. What about the sometimes over a million people a year who've been just walking across the border, and have there been penetrations of the border that were by non-Mexicans, by people who were potentially engaged in terrorist activity? You know, that's a tricky question. Less than you would think. There are about 10% of the people who come across the border these days illegally, the Mexican border, are from someplace other than Mexico, but mostly Central America. Latin America, there was a brief flurry of Brazilian enthusiasm for walking across the border that has been squelched. We had to to squelch it, we basically had to set up a system that said, if we catch you and you're not from Mexico, you will go to jail, and you will sit in jail until we can fly you back. Prior to that, because they didn't have enough space, they were saying, oh, okay, well, here's a ticket. Show up for your trial in a month. And they'd say, oh, thank you very much. Where's the bus stop? You know, and we wouldn't catch them, so it was a great way to get into the U.S. But if you're flown home to Brazil, the idea of coming back and trying to make that journey again is something that is a little daunting. So that has dramatically reduced the number of non-Mexicans who come across. We do still get, a handful, maybe, I guess, 1,000 a year who would be Middle Eastern folks or people from Somalia or someplace like that who, for one reason or another, have been flown into Mexico City and then given an opportunity to come up to the border. But they have to get through all the crooks. There is some cooperation between the U.S. and Mexico about handling people who are stopped, who are from countries like that. Not perfect. It's one of the surprise consequences of criticism. We criticized Mexico for a failure of reciprocity. They would criticize us for our treatment of illegal immigrants, and then they treated the illegal immigrants that they had much worse. So a bunch of people started criticizing them for that, and unfortunately they started implementing all these special protections for illegal immigrants that made it harder for them to cooperate when the illegal immigrants were from, you know, Lebanon. Every policy has an unanticipated consequence. The last thing, and probably the thing that is most useful in discouraging terrorist exploitation of that weakness, is that if you come across the border illegally, you have about a 50% chance of getting caught. If you're a Mexican, you don't care. You get caught, you get a bus ride back to the border, your coyote has guaranteed you at least 3 trips, so that if you get caught once, they'll give you another trip free, and another trip after that free. This is the market. And for Mexicans, you know, your coyote just meets you at the bus. If you're from a country other than that, you're going to end up in jail, and you're going to be fingerprinted, and it's good news. Most of the Border Patrol is bilingual, and they understand somebody speaking Spanish with an accent that is not really a Latin American accent. So between the fingerprinting and the informal checks on people pretending to be Hispanic that aren't, it's a risky way to get across. It's not that the defenses are foolproof. But there's a risk there that if I were advising a terrorist group, I'm not sure I'd advise them to take. Yes?
Hi, I'm Andrew Wessie from the National Security Program at Sales University. Looking at your theory here, given the environment of North Korea and perhaps Iran, how does your model apply to nuclear weapons? I see here it's a pretty steep curve with biotech, pretty steep curve with computers.
Here's my view. My view is we have been living in a kind of fool's paradise, or we've been blessed. It has the cost curve for developing nuclear weapons is declining for sure. Or, you know, people who eat grass for a diet wouldn't be able to build them. But it has been declining very slowly, at nothing like the rate at which biotech and cyber and Moore's Law are driving down the cost of those technologies. And as long as, you know, you have to refine the uranium at enormous expense, that's going to be true. That's one good thing. And the other good thing is the way in which the nuclear industry developed, you know, with a sense of original sin, you know, I am become death and all that stuff. All those guys felt bad about the fact that they've devoted their careers to killing so many people, and they devoted the rest of their careers to trying to build an industry that was responsible, and they were alert to the risks of the technology. The computer industry built their technology without the slightest inclination that they owed anything to the government or to society. They were just doing something cool, and the job of government was to stay the hell out of their way. And so they just wanted to do it without any interference. Biotech guys understand regulation, but they believe in their hearts, and this was the hardest thing to overcome. They just believe that, you know, of course this is a force for good. I mean, these are scientists. Why would they do anything bad? I would get this from NIH all the time. You know, and so, well, you know, this is research. It's got to be good because researchers are such good people. And they're going to get rich too. So they're going to have an IPO. So that's the culture. The culture is not, oh my God, how can I make sure that this is not misused? Because up to now, the experience has been this is just good. This is good for society, and it's real good for me. Yeah.
As you're handling it in your science,
I can.
Would you label the network?
Yeah. And I have to say, I owe Ken a lot. He actually did a review of this book for the Los Angeles Times, so and a relatively favorable one. I guess I didn't see a lot in General Alexander's statements that I thought was sort of groundbreaking. The bills are going to end up as one bill. They reflected, not surprisingly, this is Washington, they reflected the interests of the agencies that the committees who wrote them oversee. So the Commerce Committee thought that all of our security problems could be solved by NIST and the Department of Commerce. And the Homeland Security Committee thought that DHS was the answer to our prayers. I actually think the Armed Services Committee has been less focused on staking out vast swaths of turf and more focused on the crisis that has to be solved. So some of the focus on supply chain risk there is less turf and more, oh my God, what am I going to do? Harry Reid has said to a number of people that he wants a bill, and he wants a bill that he can attach to the Armed Services Authorization Bill. But he's now said that about so many things, and it's become so controversial that I'm a little skeptical that we're going to see a big bill this year. But that promise, that effort has, as far as I understand, produced something very close to a consensus bill between at least the Commerce Committee and the Homeland Security Committee, which are the two critical committees, with enough buy-in from armed services that it is a plausible addition to the authorization bill. And if that happens, it would be great. It's a actually surprisingly tough bill. It doesn't provide answers, but it at least provides authority to provide answers, and that's something. It's particularly true for this administration, but any administration has problems with the lawyers saying, "I'm not sure you've got authority to do that." And this would address a lot of those. These bills would address a lot of those problems, but they don't answer many of the hard questions. They authorize somebody else to answer those hard questions, and it will require that the president match his rhetoric from early in his administration. This is going to be a central theme of his administration. It's a crisis. He's the only president to have given a speech devoted solely to it and to say he's going to fix it. He's going to have to start actually cashing some of those checks if the bill passes. And, having been there and tried to cash even, small checks, I know how hard that's going to be. So we're in for a tough 5 years trying to figure out what we can do and then actually do it. Yeah.
That's the last question.
Last question. Okay. The last question there? Okay.
A short question, yes.
Earlier, what percentage of the, other than Mexicans, that show up actually get detected? How many get, more importantly, don't get
detected and come on into the U.S.? Yeah, my estimate, and this is, of course, I'm not sure I can say this, but you don't know what you don't know. This is a known unknown. But the best estimates, if you look at the people who get caught twice, it's about half as many as get caught once. So you can kind of guess that probably we caught half of the people the first time and the other half got through undetected. And so very roughly, it could easily be 70%, it could be 60%, it could be 40%, but it's in the neighborhood. It's a substantial percentage, but it is not much more than half at best. And that probably is true for the non-Mexicans as well as the Mexicans. There isn't an obvious difference by in terms of how they come across the border, though they pay more, and so maybe they get better service, although that is by no means certain in this business. Okay, thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can have 8.5 minute break. The bar is open. We'll see you back. I'll be setting up the tables for the food while you're out.